Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm Richard Collis. I'm delighted to welcome you to the annual Oxford Guernsey Lecture, organised by the Guernsey Oxford Society, which is just a group of us who are very proud to have, I was going to say educated in Oxford, that's probably true of some of us. I certainly spent 3 years there. We all enjoyed our time at the university. We're very proud of the university. And we're very keen to do what we can to promote the university in the island and to help to maintain the very strong links that exist between Guernsey and Oxford University, and in particular to encourage people to apply to the university. We're very happy to do whatever we can to support anybody who might be thinking of applying. You just want to have a bit more information about the university, which college to apply to, or even assistance in preparing for interviews, please contact us. We're happy to do whatever we can. It's good to see some other people in the audience this evening. Over the years, we've been able to attract lecturers in a wide variety of different subjects, but I don't think we've ever had a subject that's quite as topical as the one that we're going to be enjoying this evening. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Danny Dawley, who is the Harold Mackinder Professor of Geography. He has other posts and numerous publications, which I won't list, but we won't have time for this at all. But he's a British social geographer, and he specialises in themes involving issues related to social inequalities in Britain. And he's studied issues such as housing, health, employment, education, wealth and poverty, which covers just about everything. And his latest work, as you can see from there, concerns really the 2016 EU referendum and what that tells us about the modern state of Britain. So please give a very warm welcome to Professor Danny Dawley.
Thank you so much for coming along tonight. Brexit's a very emotive issue, and I'm not meaning to upset anybody, so I'll start off with this. I may upset you, but I've been doing quite a lot of talking about Brexit, and I can't make it too depressing, or I just get depressed. So I do take it very seriously. There are people who, on both sides of the argument, are greatly affected. There are people who really, really want Britain to leave the EU, desperately want to leave the EU. And there are other people whose families are being torn apart by what is going on. So I thought I always have to start off saying I'm aware of that. However, it is quite interesting. And in some times it's quite funny. I was at the airport today waiting for the flight to take off from Southampton. And the BBC news correspondent was just standing outside Parliament saying, "We haven't got a clue what's going to happen. It's just going on and on. And there may not even be a vote by Wednesday or Thursday." And if I had stood here 2 years ago and told you that we would be in this situation today, you wouldn't have believed me. You wouldn't have believed that this could actually happen, that we'd get to the situation we're in now. The other thing to say about Brexit is it's quite chastening for academics. Some academics, and these are people who study elections and opinion in Britain, will tell you that they saw it coming and they had an idea of what's going on. If they knew, they're almost certainly deluding themselves, because hardly anybody saw what was going to happen. That's something which was likely. One reason for that is that for years, the spread betting had managed to get general elections almost spot on. Spread betting is when you put your own one down and one was up. And people tend to think more carefully when they're putting their own money down, apart from simply saying what they think is going to happen. And the spread betting got the 2015 election pretty well, the 2010 election pretty well. It's almost doing the public out of the job. It just looked at the odds and where they were going. The spread betting on the referendum, the Brexit referendum won. And there's a question about why. Why didn't we realise that this could happen? And then why didn't we realise that we would still be in the situation we are in now? I wrote a book a few years ago called So You Think You Know About Britain. I was very cocky when I was younger, and I thought I really, really understood Britain. What's fascinating about all of this is what it's revealing about ourselves. And I don't think most people actually knew. So I'm going to show you a few pictures. I'm going to just talk for about 45 minutes. I am most interested in your questions, so we're going to have plenty of time for that. So, first picture. It's a graph of immigration. Because when you look at the surveys about who cared about voting legal or remain and why we had them, immigration comes up as the key issue, the most important thing. Too many people coming, countries full, out of control. We need to control our own borders. We need to have a promise of getting immigration down to the tens of thousands. This particular graph, if you were in the United States of America, this would be very familiar to you. It's the kind of graph that in the US they celebrate where people come from. You won't have seen this before because this is the only graph of its type in Britain. My friend Bethan Suyer Thomas had used it. It takes data from each census, 1841, 51, 61, and looks at the proportion, the number actually, of people who are born outside the UK. What is there in the UK? Ireland was the largest immigrant group in the 1840s. And then we got the little lines, 1901, 1911, from Eastern Europe. I can show you lots of posters, but I won't, I don't have too many slides. There's a great scare about Jewish people in particular coming over from Russia. And we brought in an Immigration Act. And the British Union, the fascists, was formed. And it was a great debate over that. 40 years later, nobody remembers being very angry about Jewish people trying to get into the country. There's a constant pattern to this with immigration. But then again, we went out to the Caribbean, and we went out to the Indian subcontinent. Enoch Powell was the health minister who actually went to the Caribbean. And we asked people to come over and be bus drivers and nurses and work in the mills in the north of England, which you couldn't get enough people to work the night shift. And people came, and then we complained again about the immigrants, and there were immigration acts and controls again in the 1960s, and the National Front became large. And then we largely kind of settled down, got used to it. Nobody can remember being very anti-immigrant in the 1950s and 1960s. The latest rise, that giant power there says Eastern European, point to it, is actually caused by this little triangle here. That's the A8 migration. Tony Blair took the UK into the agreement early, so the people from Poland in particular could come to Britain before they could come to Germany. And so a few more tens of thousands came, and then next year a few more tens of thousands came. And the most get up and go Polish summers arrived in the country. I would want to argue that it wasn't actually about immigration. Although most people, when you ask them what the problem was, they get beyond their embarrassment of not wanting to appear to be a bit nasty, we'll say, you know, this was the issue. But if you look back over time, you'll see that the country wasn't wrecked by people coming who were Jewish, it wasn't wrecked by people coming who were black. But you may look at that and say, it's going up and up and up. It goes up and up and up, because all over the world there is now more migration. The biggest immigrant group by number in the UK The biggest group who don't learn the local language, who buy their houses if you can't afford a nice house, are the English who retire to Wales. That is our largest, if you like, the most destructive immigrant group. I mean, my mother laughs a bit, so I'm not against the English who move to Wales, but if you want an example of immigrants affecting a part of the world to the detriment of people who are born there, that's the largest group. The largest number of immigrant children born in another country living in England, are children born in the United States of America living around Hyde Park. Their parents often work in finance. And again, you could make an argument. You could say all those finances who came over before 2008 didn't actually help us very much. But of course, these aren't the arguments you get about immigration. The arguments you get about immigration are 200 Roma on the east side of Sheffield are a real problem. Sheffield has a population of 500,000. It's so tough, but it's so unpredictable. Same data, just drawn a different way, putting the people who are born in the UK in. And remember, people are leaving as well. It's only about 1 million have gone from the UK to the rest of Europe. Many people from the UK go elsewhere in the rest of the world. Let's do a quick poll. How many of you were born here on this island? Okay, and how many were not born on the island?
Good boy.
Okay, so there's 2/3 of us. Okay. Checking. Here's a map. I'm afraid the island is not on my feet. It's so small you won't even see it on the map. The reason you can't see it is we stretch the map. It's a map of Europe, and it's stretched at an area proportional to the population. So that where there are lots of people living, it's large, got a tiny dot there, that's London, to give you an idea. That's Paris. And somewhere like Scandinavia gets smaller. So you're looking at Europe shaped by people. The colour on this particular map is the proportion of people who are born in another country who live there. And the yellow is less than 5%, so less than 1 in 20 were born abroad. Turkey, second point, better using that. This is Istanbul, this is Turkey. You might remember all the fear of all the Turks who are going to arrive because of the allowed in, but anyway. Less than 5% of people in Turkey were born abroad. Most of Eastern Europe, less than 5% were born abroad. And most of Britain, less than 5% born abroad. Most of Britain is remarkably similar to Eastern Europe in many ways. The mortality rate is similar. In some ways, the quality of housing is actually similar. It's a bit sad, but these are the kind of things we learn about ourselves. And one of the reasons to point this out is that the parts in the middle of West Central London, where a fifth or more people are born abroad, these are the parts that didn't vote to leave. Almost the strongest correlation with voting to leave is how few immigrants were in your area. It's about 0.79. There's a slightly stronger correlation, which we can get into, which the poor academic who released it 3 weeks after the vote was crucified for, because he wasn't. That's cool. 0.8 correlation is with obesity. The more people who are fat in an area, the more likely that area is to have a lot of lead voters. I feel I'm okay talking about this subject. I'm just on that kind of limit. I don't know if I would do a talk like this in Essex and explain that. The academic did make a bit of an error. He made an assumption. He said people who are fatter are not so good at planning or careful and just don't think well enough. And that isn't true. For those of you in the audience who might be done like me, we have wonderful new genetic evidence since the genome-wide analysis began about why some people are fatter and some are thinner. Once you give people lots and lots of food, some become fatter, and it's largely actually down to genes. And some become thinner, no matter, or stay thinner, no matter how much food. Everybody's failed in the 70s, because there's less. Anyway, it's not the fatness. Why should you get that correlate with lean growth and fatness? One thing, I'm going to go on about it too much. The 3 million immigrants to Britain that came in from the European Union were young, fit, healthy, and well educated. And they largely went to places where there was work, places doing well, places like London. And they arrived with their young, fit bodies. And it wasn't just that they took the average for the area down. But when there were lots of thin people in your city, it actually has an effect on you. You try not to eat so many chips and burgers because you feel larger. I'll leave you for questions if you want to explore that. Let's get back to this. There are greens and blues in the northwest of Europe. There are greens and blues in the northwest of Europe for what we now know as a very simple reason. There are essentially no borders in much of the mainland of Europe. You live in the Netherlands, somebody else just lives 20 miles up the road in Germany. You like each other, you get married, you have to live somewhere. One of you will officially be an immigrant. It doesn't matter. There isn't a border. That's why you have high migration rates in most of the centre of Europe. This is Switzerland. Switzerland has mountains in the middle. So most of the population of Switzerland live there and have a country and people come in and go out. Very common migration. The UK has the channel. And that little bit of water is enough to make it more difficult and also a lack of economic opportunity. The UK has not been doing as well as northwestern Europe. Economically, apart from London, loads of people just have a car. But if you tell people that people are coming, and if you tell them for 30 years, it's the immigrants, it's the immigrants, it's the immigrants. The reason why your schools aren't very good is the immigrant children. The reason the waiting list for the hospital is long is the immigrants. The reason why you can't afford a house is that the immigrants are buying the houses, and by the way, they're also depressing the wages. And you say it enough, and you say it repeatedly, people are going to believe you. And if you don't tell them the other reasons, which is that most of northwestern Europe spends more on education and has a more sensible education system than England, that they control their house prices, that they can't rise up and up, that they spend more on their health service and the health service is better. In the UK, we would have to spend €1 billion a week to spend on health, what the Germans spend on their health service. But nobody told anybody that. They put 350 million on the side of a bus. You know, if I had a bus, I'd have put 1 billion and 14 million, which is the German spending. With the slogan, why can't we be more like Germany? Which is why I was a politician. When they were. But nobody was telling people these reasons. And the interesting question is why not? Why did they go on and on about immigration? And it was actually, for most of the country, remarkably low. Where it isn't low is in Ireland. It isn't low in the north of Ireland or south of Ireland. And this is not because lots of Polish people came to Ireland. A few did. There's a meatpacking plant in Belfast which relies on immigrant labour. But it isn't because of Eastern European migration. The reason there's a high immigrant rate in Ireland is very simple. There is no border in Ireland. There's been no border in Ireland since the Good Friday Agreement. That is what the agreement was about. Now the politicians who made that agreement knew what it was about. But they decided not to tell people in England what the agreement was about. They just said, oh, don't worry, no more violence. There is no border. It's more complicated than that, in that the UK never really accepted Ireland leaving. So you have rights, or you have kind of de facto rights, because nobody took the rights away with an Irish passport. be where you want. But it does matter now. It really matters now. And the reason why you can't put a border back in, or buy a supercomputer and put driving code and have some amazing electronic system to check the milk flows, is because that high number of people who are directly affected because they would be an immigrant otherwise on that island. That's the point out for this year. This is the immigrant centre of Spain, half of Madrid. It's a Costa del Sol. And it's particularly interesting for us because the largest group of immigrants in the Costa del Sol, we don't call them immigrants because we British never immigrate. We are expats. They're British and they're loved. And they won't come back immediately. They'll come back when they're ill because they won't be able to use the hospital in Spain, at least without paying for it. This is again one of the ironies that wasn't realised. We had two deals. One deal, I say me because I'm English, one deal we had was that we don't actually pay our fair share into the EU. Margaret Thatcher negotiated that we'd pay less. But we don't tell people much about that. But by far the biggest deal we have is unique in the whole of the European Union. We attracted continuously young, fit, able, highly qualified people who we hadn't paid for them to care for as a baby, we hadn't paid for their schools, we hadn't paid for their universities. And they came in huge numbers continuously, and then usually left a few years later, and did all the jobs we didn't want to do for no pay. Well, we made them pay a really high price of rent in about £500 somewhere in the south of England, so the landlord would go on cruises or go down to the cost of their soul. At the same time as we did that, we sent out 1.5 million old people to die in the EU27, in Greece, Malta, and Spain. If you had a bit more money, it's France. David Cameron's dad died in France, Nick Clegg's dad died in France. It was an unbelievable demographic deal. You take our bubbles, we'll take where we are. It's because the UK is a bit exciting. Had, and I say had, a good reputation. Cosmopolitan, multicultural, good music, you can speak the same language. It'd be fun for a few years. A third of the midwives in central London are EU but not UK citizens. Because you wouldn't be a midwife in central London unless you had a very well paid partner, because it's central London. Anyway, try and write a little bit. It's quite amazing. It's quite amazing. You've got to try to work out why. Of the 28 states, why this one? There was one place that left before the EU was created, when it was just the European Community. And that place was Cleveland. And it was physically separate. It was a long way away. It thought it was part, more part of America than this dominant kind of colonial continent, which was controlling Greenland. But they didn't just go off in a huff. They had 56,000 people. So they negotiated there for 3 years. And they got a deal. And the deal Greenland got is that we will pay 500 euros per child to help Greenland fund the schools. And they, in return, will be allowed to come here because they're Danish citizens and work if they want to. And we get access to the fish, because they have not fish. And that's what the deal looks like. In case you're wondering what the deal is, Greenland's not here. And this is fascinating. I mean, I would have said 2 years ago, oh, we'll get a deal. We can now look at why we haven't got a deal. These are the polls in the run-up of the referendum. The graph is showing you the proportion of the electorate. We often forget about all the people who didn't vote. But the result in terms of the election was even prior to it, it was 38 Leave, 37 Remain. And it's all over the place. It wasn't a settled view of the British people that slowly converged on something. After the banking crash, 2008, 2009, Leave was very strong. And we've had Leave ever since Margaret Thatcher lost power, after she lost control of her party, when she had to resign. Margaret Thatcher was very, very good at controlling her MPs, almost with a rod of iron. The minute she went, John Major was stabbed in the back by the Brexiteers, and we carried on and on. Dave Cameron, who'd always been lucky all his life, if you're trying to understand why things happened, it's important to understand that Dave had always been lucky. Only one in three boys from Eton get into Oxford, Cambridge. Actually scores were slightly higher, one in three. Now that is kind of the purpose of going to Eton nowadays, as it used to be. In the past you could go into the Guards more easily or straight into the city, but now you've got to go to the university for Eton. And if they're paying £25 a year, it really has to go to Cambridge. But only one in three get in. He didn't just get in, he got into Brasenose, which is a nice old college with a unicorn. He also had a good time there. Despite having a good time, he got a first class degree. And his friend Boris got a 2-1. That's when it began. Got a nice girlfriend. He got a £90,000 job in the city, somebody made a phone call. He becomes an MP relatively young. He becomes a party leader very young. He runs a Husky. Everybody loves him. He then goes and wins an election that only said he could win in 2015. Amazingly, with a majority. The only problem is he promised to hold a referendum to try to hold his party together. But everything had always gone right for that. And so even though George Osborne told him not to do it, he called a referendum, but he was careful. He called it with a Remain to Remain here. And they thought they couldn't lose. And then that happened. And there's the map result. And it's the most amazing map. You'll have to take my word for it. I have drawn more maps of the UK than any other human geographer. I'm not particularly proud of it. My children call me Sheldon, and they are obsessed. But you will have to believe me, this is not like any other map. Most maps of the social geography in the UK look very similar. The map of who doesn't do well at school, looks like the map of where the house prices are low, looks like the map of unemployment, looks like the map of labour benefit. So after a time, even if you're as obsessed and tenacious as me, you get a bit bored of drawing maps of the UK. But this isn't a map of deprivation or anything else. This is absolutely new, this particular result. The correlation of deprivation is 0.03. No. If you're wondering how can that be, because you may know people in Oxford and London, and you notice the poorer parts of Oxford and London are both at Leave, the answer is, it's the richer parts of Devon that voted Leave, and the poorer parts of Devon that didn't. And there are just as many places and just as many people with that inverse relationship as with what happened in the posher. Why did posher parts of Devon vote Leave? Because the posher parts of Devon is where the old people live. And it's the older people who voted Leave more than anything else. This is just who got the majority for Remain, which is yellow, who got the majority for Leave, which is blue, and over there is the proportions, if you're more interested in that. The key thing, really, really key, is that the majority of the blue is in the south. And this is something we got wrong really early on. The story on the night of the referendum has all been scripted. Joe had just been murdered by a man who shouted Britain first and he murdered her. You know, once you put that on top of the spread betting results, They sat in W1A and they had their scripts. It was going to be the most boring referendum night ever. And it didn't go to plan. Sunderland always gives you results early because Sunderland has a tradition of getting school children to run with ballot papers. So Sunderland comes out early. It's a real pity it happened somewhere in the south. And the camera zoomed in, if you can remember, even the weather. Normally people stayed up to watch it because we knew what was going to happen. The camera zoomed in on a blonde lady and two men of my age without very much hair. And the story was said. It's the North, it's the working class. They did it. The majority of Leave voters live in the south of England. The majority of Leave voters normally vote Conservative or UKIP. The majority of Leave voters are social class A, B, or C, 1. I'm going to say it a few more times in different ways. This is a couple of the most important things we're going to have to learn. And the one thing we know for definite is the geography. The social class ABC1, the voting we know thanks to Lord Ashcroft. Lord Ashcroft paid for an enormous exit poll. I suspect the reason Lord Ashcroft paid for an exit poll, an exit polls are really good, because you can remember between voting and walking out of the hall. I sound that wrong about it. If you ask people in Britain whether they voted, 90% tell you they voted for the referendum. And they believe it, because we reconstruct memories of our town. The elite areas, the Watch Park in London, this is Oxford, that's Cambridge, absolutely remember. But also Cardiff, Bristol, Liverpool, Manchester. Scotland is another different enemy. For Scotland, Brussels is London. Hence, Scotland doesn't fit at all. And the majority of Northern Ireland voted for Man, the very divided. Wales was actually spot on the national average. But we managed to do a disservice to the Welsh by reporting continuously how did they run the league. They voted the exact UK average, league vote and not voting. And if you were to take those English retirees out of Wales, who tend to read the Western Daily News, which is the Daily Mail in Wales, Wales would be a remain country. Here's the distribution by age. 18 to 24 year olds, 70% are in debt. Or, well, whatever they were doing, they weren't voting. Okay? Now, that's normal. That's normal. Ever since 1991, 70% of that age group haven't voted. You may forget what happened in 1991, if you were lucky, it never happened here. We brought in a special tax called a poll tax, where you have to pay the same no matter how much money you had. What happens when you do that? This age group don't register to vote. That's when it began. At 92, 97, every election since the poll tax, the young haven't voted, not haven't registered to vote. The brilliant news about Brexit, there's loads of silver linings with Brexit, is that the young are now voting again. They voted like anything in the election of 2017. They're suddenly interested in politics. Those who did vote, those who got to remain, it didn't matter, it's most of the vote. 25 to 34 year olds, majority of men, but a high number of vote. Come over here, 65 plus, which really should be stretched, it's a much bigger group because people live longer now. And you've got almost 90% voting. Because that's what you do. But it isn't any old 65 plus year old who votes. The people over 65 who really vote live in the south of England, where it's almost a religious thing to go and vote. So it's kind of higher. But it's the other. And I've got about a quarter of an hour, so I'm not going to go into great depth about why it's the other. But this is one of the most fascinating things. My co-author, Sally Tomlinson, is an education expert. And one thing Sally does is she looks at school textbooks. School textbooks in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and what people were taught. If she were here tonight, she would read you quotes from the particular geography textbook used in the prep school that Boris Johnson went to. It explains Boris. He's not that maverick or unusual. He was taught at school about differences between the races. The word Piccadilly was in his textbooks at that age in that school. The idea of the British Empire being great, having control, natural destiny to something better, was there and it's kind of been taken out and rolled down and down again. This is the dollars in the pound at the time. When my grandmother was young, that's why it was the pound. When my mum was young, it was four. When I was a child, it was three. When my oldest child was born, it was two. We're going to be one at some point fairly soon. When I first left England on a school trip at the age of 15, I went to France. The exchange rate was 10 francs to a pound. 3 francs would buy you a bottle of wine. 3 bottles of wine and a bit for a pound. Right? We were kids. Something gone wrong, something that isn't working. And if you tell the population, well, first of all, you told them, I think, what you tell them originally, English disease, they turn to trade unions, socialists, and then when they are in power, you want to come up with something else. You start with the immigrants again, because it worked in 1905, and it worked in 1916. So you tell them the problem is immigrants, and then adding into that, you tell them the problem is, it's also this thing called Europe. It's the undemocratic European Union, which if only we were unfettered from that, we could be back to the rightful place where we should be. And what's more, that European Union, it's letting the immigrants in. We can't do anything about the immigrants because of the European Union. There are real reasons why the relative position of Britain slipped down, of which by far the most important is that 100 years ago we were the richest large place on the planet because we owned a quarter of it. Now we never told ourselves, again in history textbooks in this case, we never told ourselves the reason that this country, where I'm from, is incredibly affluent is because other people had to buy our stuff. Not just other people had to buy our stuff, but we actually took other people and we shipped them over to America and we made them pick cotton and we took the cotton back to Manchester because that's the logical place in which you're going to build cotton. Then we forced people in India to buy the cotton because we couldn't let them make garments themselves on the subcontinent, but they could do something else, they could grow elephants, which we then took in gunships to China and told them in the name of free trade they had to buy. And all that makes you rich. None of that's in the history textbooks. It's in the head history textbooks of every Chinese child. I've yet to meet a Chinese student who doesn't know what the opium wars were. What was in my history textbooks was the spinning jet. I had to learn Arkwright. I had to memorize the names of men from more distant parts of the country who through their genius have made this country rich. If you don't tell people the other story, because it's a bit embarrassing. Now think about where the colonies go over time. And think about the slipping down the country. And think when the shipyards had to close. And it's not going to be easy, I think, telling this different story, but you're going to have that different story. Already a couple of 100,000 people have not turned up in the EU. Of course, immigration doesn't go down. All that happens is that people come from elsewhere. Immigration controls never control immigration. They just alter where people come from. Last thing on the geography. And the nice thing about this is it's a deficit. It's not my opinion. The only thing we know for certain for the last voter is exactly how many people voted Leave, Remain, and did not vote who were on the electoral roll in each area. And I'll just read you out Hampshire. There are more people who voted Leave in Hampshire than the combined Leave voters of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland combined, despite all those seven areas having a bigger electorate than Hampshire. But nobody goes to Hampshire and does TV programmes about Leave. So the beginnings of, you know, what we've learned about ourselves is that people are very disgruntled in Hampshire. Theresa May goes to Stoke-on-Trent to do a talk about Brexit. It'd be much easier just to nip down the road to Winchester to do it. Kent, I mean, near a radio. But more Leave voters in Kent, and Barbara Blackpool, Longford, Sheffield, which is 500,000, where you are, half a quarter combined. All things about 26 counties in the south of England. And for every single one of them, and London, I can find a set of areas outside of the southeast with a bigger electorate and more people voted Leave in the southern county. And I'm not using the same area twice. I don't know how to get this area, but I'm going to spend the next 20 years of my life going about it, and somebody, you know, takes me out of my misery about it. It's a southern vote. Because it was a majority old vote, makes it the old living. And the old in the south actually turn out to vote more than the old do in the north. You may say, well, all those people who didn't vote in the Harvey Hall, they didn't vote Leave. They're young. Why didn't they vote Leave? It's a fascinating thing. Here's the map of the Empire, particularly weird map. We've drawn a circle for every place that we think was in it. We put the date for when we walked in and told them that they were ours, and the date for when they told us to get lost, in effect. The first significant one to go was the 13 colonies of America. We burnt down the White House, but they still managed to escape. And after that, we became particularly affected. We weren't the most brutal empire. The Belgians were the worst. And the French were pretty nasty. But we were better at it than anybody else. Partly because we weren't the most brutal. And it was enormous. And India was a jewel in effect. If you're old, you may remember Hong Kong, the so-called last colony going in 1997. And on the day of it going, you might remember the iconic image is Chris Patten, the last governor, wiping the tear from his daughter's eyes as the Union Jack was lowered and the ship set off and the sun set on the Empire. And there were so many, this is the nicest story I can tell you, so I'm not going to tell you any corporate way of our stories, this is the nicest one. She cried for 3 hours that day. She wasn't crying about the British Empire. And she wasn't crying about Hong Kong. She was crying because she had a lovely boyfriend who was also a surfer, who she had to leave, and she didn't understand why the hell she couldn't hang around back in Hong Kong. And why was he taking her back to England? Because a young girl cries for 3 hours over that, she doesn't cry for 3 hours over the fact that Britain has lost control of a chunk of the ground he's made control in the Opium War. So many things. We haven't pulled up there lately. And we're really, really odd. Yeah. You may not be, you're not part of this group who got a vote. There are many other people like you, by the way, who did get a vote. We have 7 million people not registered because we changed the way in which you can register the vote, so it's much harder to register. There's all those EU citizens inside England, Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland that didn't get a vote. Lots of people living abroad who did. Said for too long at the moment. But we look at the test. These are the national percentages of people who've never been on the protest. The second most boring country in the whole of Europe is Germany. Only 1 in 3 Germans have ever been on a protest. And the number of people from the UK who've been on a protest is half. But maybe that we didn't need to go on. Yeah. This is a question, nothing bad, that bad, has happened for a long time. The current attitude in England right now is, it will all be sorted out. Don't worry. There is no paddy pie. Nothing. Toilet rolls, sanitary products, potatoes, rice. None. There's no idea that it might be possible that on the 29th of March we could crash out.
Yes.
And that would have any particularly negative effect amongst the general population. The upper middle class are quietly buying their lentils in Oxford. But so far, not a single Oxford college has actually stocked up his kitchen, as far as I know. Although they're quite well stocked anyway. There's enough wine to get it through. But it is remarkable that the degree of complacency is quite incredible. The one thing I think people are doing is they're not booking their holidays. One airline has gone bust. And you said you don't want to book with a non-flag carrier by you. Now, but I don't say too loudly because I don't want to be responsible. The reason we don't, in case you don't know, is that if we did crash out with hard Brexit, then a flight which are not there or back would be illegal. On those routes, you cannot economically do it by going there and back. What you do is you have a plane that sets off in Nice Bradford, it flies down to Nice, flies up to Warsaw, flies somewhere else, ends up at 9 o'clock at night in Nice Bradford. So you can fly again with a jet to Nice Bradford at 6 in the morning again to Nice. And it makes enough money that it can keep going. You can work out all the European airports which won't be able to function, which is largely in Poland, if there's a hard Brexit. Last complicated graph. I'll give 5 more minutes and then we'll do questions. The UK is odd. Really, really, really odd. People accuse me often of a thing called British exceptionalism. I don't understand why this is a sin to argue for British exceptionalism, saying that the reason why we behave in a lot of ways is that we are different. The reason why we're different is the empire which made us very rich and we haven't adapted to not being so rich. There are other exceptional countries in the world. If you look at the most economically unequal countries of the rich world, you'll find places like the United States of America, where odd things happen, or Russia, where odd things happen. Of all the EU 28 states, the one with the biggest inequality is the UK. The best off 10%, I'm in the best off 10%, we take 40% of all income. We leave 60% where the rest 90% of people live on. All countries with high inequality are unhappy countries. You can do some quote about parallels, I won't put it. They're all different, but they're all unhappy. This is coming externally. 2002, we were spending about 36-37% of our GDP on public spending. Labour were very, very naughty, a little bit up and up and up. That was in about 4, it was very naughty. Goes up here, then our banks, everybody goes up. Ireland took our advice, which was a good advice. And then we begin this thing. But we're all in that. And this is also in the cuts down to 36%. And that's why our health service is not well funded, and your secondary schools are asking. I got a letter from the school my kids go to yesterday, saying, please, can we have some money? Doesn't happen elsewhere. This is the conservative rate. And if you think I'm being a partisan, I've got the Amazon wage. The Labour Manifesto of 2017, we think that one adopted the clear here. That's what Jeremy Corbyn is proposing. Going from there to there. Which for Britain is quite radical, but Finland, 56%. France, about 55%. Denmark, 53%. Belgium, 51%. Sweden, 50%. That's normal European countries. Free tertiary education. Good health services. Social safety net. There are two countries which have the highest number of people on the street per head in Europe. They are the UK and Germany. And Germany only ranks also the UK because they let 1.5 million Syrians in, of which I think it might be about 70,000 are still living in tents on the flyovers. You take them out and the UK is fucked. I don't like going through these things about what's wrong about England because I'm born here, but and I didn't used to. But you're trying to explain what's happened and why it might have happened. And things are changing. Things are changing partly as a result of that referendum. You give people a choice where their only choice was to vote for the status quo, vote for Mr. Cameron, and the Labour Party, which agreed with the May, and the Liberals, and the Greens, and the Trade Union Council, which agreed with the May, and the CBI, and the Church, and the BBC. And everybody tells you, we're going to give you a choice. By the way, this is what you should do. And maybe in hindsight it's not quite so surprising that 52% didn't. The old voted out not because they're selfish, they voted out for their grandchildren. They want something better. They're probably not going to get it. Although you never know, in a kind of weird way they might. The nearest thing to this that's happened in recent British history is the Suez crisis. This is Suez times 20. We can't work it out because the exchange rate was fixed at Suez, so you can't actually work out how much bigger the Suez it is. And the Suez crisis was very embarrassing. We were told when it happened we couldn't do that. That canal wasn't ours. It was Egypt's. We suddenly realised we were much smaller than we were. But out of that embarrassment of the Suez crisis, there came an understanding that the people in charge didn't really know what's going on, that you could change things. And within a few years, you got the 1960s, you got books that have been banned because they talked about a lady sleeping with her partner. You know, suddenly you could read that, and it wasn't at the end of the world. Even if your wife and servants read it, it would be okay. Now, I'm an optimist. I think somehow after Brexit, we're going to get another kind of 1960s. I think it's exposed, and this week will expose, to a whole younger generation, the absolutely inability of those who are supposed to be in power to get what they said they would get. It's kind of trust us, don't worry your silly little heads over this, it'll all be okay. Let's zoom on. Last graph. I have 2 minute graphs. There we go. Why can we get there? Why do we get 588 pages, which isn't a deal? And it's not just me telling you it's not a deal. 588 pages, which on the 15th of January, got the worst defeat of any government ever in British history when it was presented to the Members of Parliament. And this maybe gives you an idea about why we ended up that. 588 pages, by the way, with only 115 words on the finance industry of Britain. There's supposed to be another shadow minus of being afterwards. Standard 4 produced this graph, and I led this, three simple questions. Standard 4 produced this before the referendum. It's their estimate of which other countries would be most affected by Brexit, if Britain voted to leave. The most affected was Ireland, which they kind of got right, although Dublin is now doing incredibly well. Because if you want to be in the EU and you want your children to learn English, that's where you go. 5,000 parties, bankers to go there. Malta. Malta is small. Luxembourg is small. Cyprus is small. Switzerland is not in the EU, so it doesn't get a say. Belgium is small. The Netherlands is small. Spain. Okay, then this benefits a bit from tourists. So they will benefit from not having to look after the art. That's why we haven't got a deal. We didn't matter that much. Standard and Poor's do, we didn't matter that much. 10% of German cars are sold in the UK. But people still say, oh, the Germans will want a deal because they want to sell their cars to us. Where do you think people in Britain are going to get a car in the future? The Swindon plant's closed down, the Nissan plant will be closing down, the Cowley plant, mile from my house, will shut down on the 29th of March, supposedly can be open 3 weeks later, before the shutdown earlier. You still need cars. We're still getting 10% of German cars, and just in little cars from Germany. So you won't be able to afford the big cars that we used to get from Germany. That's the situation we're in now. You can do lots of arguing about the lack of democratic accountability in the EU. I'm very happy to talk about that. Personally, I happen to think this has been a brilliant wake-up call for the EU. I think that the EU27 are sorting things out. And it's worth asking, to what extent were we not helping before? We sent, in 2014, the largest number of far-right MEPs to the Parliament of any country by far. Our Conservative Party had joined a Green Group alternative with Deutschland in 2014. The bulk of the European far-right are actually British MEPs. And we talk about rising populism in Europe. My only worry about delay, I would like a delay. My only worry is there have to be elections in May. And will we send 80 far-right MEPs to European Parliament? Or will we not? Because normally only a third of people vote in European elections. And this is the last thing I'll say about this, how little we do. And I wish, because I'm egotistic and narcissistic, I'd see it. 2014 European election. The proportion of people who voted for political parties in the right mainstream conservatives in 2014 in Britain was 52.9%. Right? The voters were telling us. And we were supposed to know what's going on, and they look at all of this, didn't see it. Way back in the 1970s, the proportion of people in European elections who voted far right was zero. There were no candidates. It's an incredible change in the country. It ramped up and up slowly. It's got us to a situation now when the shares of Lloyds are half what they were in June 2016, and Barclays are approaching half. The assumption is that there will be no hard Brexit. There's 500 MPs, no more than hard Brexit. And they're probably hoping. My worry is, there's so many things I haven't seen coming. It is entirely possible that somehow, over the next few days, a couple of weeks, we actually don't manage to arrange something. And leave, not because we actually, like we are our elected officials, wanted to leave. We end up leaving because the level of incompetence is so incredibly high at the top of Britain. Devil to the fishing. If we don't believe like that, you should celebrate and be happy. And remember, it takes a lot to get young people out of bed, but this at least has done it. The last time we had a young generation who really wanted things to be different was the 1960s, but the time before that, where they were most affected, were the young people who came back from the Second World War, the second war that we could have actually avoided having, with absolutely no respect for their elders and changed things utterly. Brexit is much, much better than war. I think it's going to result in better things in the United Kingdom in years to come, but it's going to be acrimonious for years to come, and it's not going to end for years to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you. in Little England. I must say that I was totally against Brexit. I certainly have no grief for the Theresa May government, which I think in the last 2 years has been one of the most incompetent in modern British political history. I do think, however, that you have been somewhat unbalanced and scathing in your portrayal of the United Kingdom. Certainly you have been somewhat one-sided in your portrayal of British imperial history, particularly while one thinks it was actually Britain that outlawed slavery well over 200 years ago, and the institution of slavery in 1833.
Is there a question?
There is a question. The question is, by implication, whether it was intentional or not, you appear to suggest that things were so much better in other countries in Europe, in Italy, and there is the question, in Italy, that's already in recession. Germany is just missing by its very neck. 48% of German GDP is export-led. When there's a trade war, that's going to be particularly badly affected. In Spain, I think it's arguably it's hardly a function of democracy when you think of what it does in Barcelona and other places. Look at other countries in the European Union, when you're talking about Hungary or Poland or various other countries.
Still no question.
There is a question coming. You obviously don't have any patience. The question is, would you, in your academic, immensely scathing way, like to make a comment about the sustainability of the European Union as a political and economic construct? I hope, sir, whoever was interrupting, that is enough of a question.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a very good question, because this in Oxford and London is what we get a lot of. If I say this, I get people often say what you said, and it's partly. Sally Michael-Orff is better at answering these questions than me. But she'll say, and it's because of these beliefs that this happened. For instance, yes, we did ban slavery, but we also orchestrated the slave trade in the first place. Okay? Spain and Portugal is two. You can go on, but we don't teach children about that. We teach them about the enemy as if it was somebody else doing it. On relative positions. And these are things people don't know. When I was born in the UK, it was just about the best place to be born as a baby. We had incubators at the John Radcliffe in Oxford. Your chances of survival were about the best in the world. By 1990, it's the neonatal rights. Germany, Sweden, France, Finland, Luxembourg, and Denmark were better, but we were seventh. By 2015, we shot down to 19th. Down here is Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Malta. That's 2015. Italy is up there at number 11, having got relatively better. Since 2015, the infant mortality rate in the UK alone amongst the whole of Europe has gone up 3 times. A baby is more likely to die this year than last year, more likely to die last year than the year before. Life expectancy has fallen since 2014, the only European country now in which it has fallen. People in the UK don't know this. They know about the failures of other countries in Europe, but they don't know how our failures compare to their failures. Before Brexit, I would have said the European Union was in trouble, particularly over Greece. I think France, with a friend of mine, went to Castro, from Antipastro, in Athens. Since Brexit, however, we've done something which I think you couldn't have imagined. Nobody before Brexit realised how important a tiny landlord is. Any tiny landlord. Greece has all the Bulgaria. You cannot easily leave, is what's been demonstrated. Furthermore, the country which is most arguing for the things that people don't like about the EU, that simply let the free market force its way, has no longer been able to argue for that because it's leaving. The country which most likes introducing some important regulation, which is Britain, our civil service put in more regulations than any others into the EU, is no longer doing that. The Greeks are talking to the Germans, and there's a sense of how can we work things out, and a quiet sense of actually taking some of the criticisms on board. So my view is that Brexit has actually made the EU27 much more stable and solid. And the biggest thing that may happen is the spreading of British bankers. British bankers' salaries have been falling since summer 2016. The European Banking Authority actually publishes the data on salaries. We had over 2,700 bankers paid over €1 million a year. The next highest country was Germany with 197. Banking was incredibly concentrated in London. And it's now beginning, just beginning, not disastrously fast, but enough to spread to Frankfurt and Munich and Paris and Amsterdam and Dublin. And spread banking back across the continent so that your bankers are not separated from the industries and the people that they should be helping and supporting. And none of that would have happened without Brexit. So my gut feeling is that the European project is actually much stronger as a result of this. I could be wrong. The nice thing is we're going to find out. But I don't expect another country to try to leave in the next 5 or even 10 years. Partly as a result of this country trying to leave and possibly bungling the way of leaving. If we managed to find a way of leaving and have an agreement 6 months ago or a year ago, kind of gracefully exited, then it would be easier to see the EU falling apart. But the way we're doing it is the way which I think strengthens inadvertently the EU27. But we'll find out. Neither of us know what's going to happen. All we can know is what has just happened. I'm still after something who's female. But you, this terrible to get this wrong. Which a colleague of mine has done. He said, laying in the back of my hand with very long hair.
As a student preparing to leave for university, what do you think the implications of Brexit are, especially for a small island for students who are actually going to leave the island to go to university? What do you think the implications of Brexit are going to be for us as new students who are
okay, I'll do short. I think the implications are better for you because I think the world will change faster in a way which is beneficial. Supposing you've gone to university and been fairly successful, maybe not in London's work, you could have thought of spending all your life in London. So it's actually becoming the middle class option. And that's very annoying because most of your salary goes on rent. And young people are losing out, older people are doing very well. So I think things will be better. I don't know enough about Brexit. So I said I wasn't going to do this to myself in life, but the option of being Guernsey like Guernsey in the long term is probably diminished. And when I look around the world, I look at places like Bohemia, which is of course part of France. I look at Orkney, I look at Saint-Germain. And I kind of think the particular deal you have at the moment is possibly not sustainable given Brexit. The question is what kind of deal we have in the future. You've got to remember one reason that the leading Brexiteers, Jacob Rees-Mogg, wanted for Brexit was to avoid European Union tax legislation reaching the UK. Now, if they manage to do that, then a wall will in effect appear along the channel. Because the EU27 are not going to allow the UK to be an offshore tax island itself. And of course, if London starts behaving like that, that has huge implications for Guernsey. We don't know. We just don't know how this is going to play out. it's worth thinking, in an ideal world, if things change, in which way would you like them change? But given we've had 2 years to watch the UK losing and the EU27 winning without even trying, I think you can see which side is great nothing on it. But I think it's good news for the young and potentially good news for the old. Because the old maybe just care about the young. Yeah, they weren't voting for Brexit because they could have more holidays and better time. Yeah. They saw, and you see this across Britain in the areas which voted Leave in the south, they saw that they had a house worth £350,000. But their children were struggling and were often renting or living in somewhere really poky that cost them a fortune. And their grandchildren were amassing enormous debt to go to university and didn't have much future at all. So I think things are going to get better, but not immediately. The immediate future is a poorer country, regardless of what happens. Partly because we've reduced or diminished the kind of brand that we have people to sell the brand. And the brand was inflated. It was an overplayed brand. So what we need to really care about is with our universities, we need to make sure they're actually good. We can't just sell them on the grounds that they're British anymore, which is what we're doing. And we need to think about things like tourism, which is a pair of jobs we can actually do more of, and it's a nice short-term feeling, or maybe not as well. Because what the great legacy of empire is, it leaves you some old buildings that the world's middle class want to see. And the world's middle class is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And after they've done London, and they've done Paris and New York, they want to come somewhere else. And rather than resisting that, it's gearing up for that. Working out what a smaller Europe as a whole is going to do in a world which is becoming more equal. This continent is disproportionately rich. And not disproportionately rich because it was disproportionately able. Another question?
Sorry. Do
you want to shout it out?
Yes. I've read much about how the demography is changing. So the older people are dying off pretty rapidly. The younger people are becoming enfranchised. So if we did have a new referendum, it would be fairly clear in favour of Remain. Is that your view?
No. It's a guess. Which, I mean, in theory, should be, given the deaths that have occurred already. If everybody voted the same way as they voted before, Remain should win if we had a second referendum. The problem is it won't be the same referendum. It's a different kind of question. And the other problem, I'll put this picture up, because I think I'm right at the end there. You may not know Dominic. This is College Oxford history. That's Dominic Cummings. And he's not all powerful, but you have to understand that the Leave campaign was absolutely serious. But they thought they were going to lose, that they were planning to just lose. Boris Johnson's face on the day was a picture. He was so upset that they won. The idea was you lose the first referendum and then win the second to Leave, by which time you have a plan. But they weren't. Now, our bags is £8 million, wherever it came from, it's gone. But there's a lot more money for this. And it's serious money. If you looked in detail at Sally, the Brexiteers, the men who funded where they grew up, disproportionately in the colonies, disproportionately had black servants, but also the angry young men who they employed, and what drives that. And they are determined that Britain should fulfil its rightful place in the world. And it's not just them. George Osborne, who was against this, is now the editor of the Evening Standard in London, which is the most pro-Remain paper. 2015, George Osborne announced that if you followed his economic plan, then the UK would become the richest large country in the world by 2030. Just 11 years away. And the key question to ask is, why did George Osborne think it was so important that the UK becomes the richest country in the world. We have this set of thinking. There was something I didn't realise about George Osborne until I got his civil servants told me. So I did a lot of work on housing and how it's affordable and what we do about housing prices. And the civil servant came up to the Treasury after the talk and he said, you do know that we actually measure our success by how high the house price is in London. Because the city with the highest house price is the economically most successful city. And why you got that kind of thinking, as opposed to how they think about housing in Vienna, or in Paris, or in the Netherlands? Well, you've got a thinking that the most expensive city is the best city, because that's what London was at the height of empire. And it really matters to be number one. You're not going to be thinking, how can we become a normal, nice place of solidarity where the average living standards are good. And that's my worry about the number one thing. All the tabloids will need to leave, the money will need to leave, and lots of the bases will be for leave, and you can stoke it up. My wife and my daughter are going on the march, and they're the last one, so we disagree inside our household on this. But my other thing, and I can see why people are wrong, I didn't agree with the first referendum. I don't think referendums are a sensible way of doing this. But we may get one. I think the most likely thing is we get a delay of 21 months. Which is long enough to organise the referendum. We'll ask for a delay of 2 or 3 months, and the EU27 will come back and say, no, 20 more months, we can't be bothered with you, not in about 2 or 3 months. We may get a referendum. If we do, apparently it has to be just 2 questions. You have to change out the Parliament to be allowed for 3. Is there somebody over here? Yeah. You've got a shout out.
I'm asking a question. Can you hear me properly?
Yes.
So you know about the Brexit, there's a, well, just generally in Europe and the West, there's a rise in primary populism. Mm-hmm. And from what I know, because I used to be a primary populist, but now I'm much, I'm not sure I am, but it doesn't really matter. One of their main things they hinged on before they still do, one of their, they see one of their greatest achievements in Brexit happening. But that's I'm wondering if when it does happen, how will the effects affect their popularity, like for example, if the result of Brexit actually happening, if it has positive effects on the UK, at least in the short term.
Yeah, what we can do is we can chart the right. Depends how you define populism. But we can chart the rise around the world. And the fascinating thing is the world's most illegal countries like Brazil and the USA have done it. And we did it with the half of Brexit we've done so far, the US more with Trump. The third one was supposed to be France when Le Pen was going to win. And the French really did a nice one. All got together, a large number of them, what was it, 65-70%, and voted for somebody they largely didn't like, that little bloke, to stop the pair. And that's a country with a degree of solidarity, actually, in a deep debate. This is the rise of the far right. 1989, the National Front got 0.1% in the elections. 94, they got 0.1%. By 1999, we had Jimmy Goldsmith's referendum party, 7.5. 2004, UKIP won 20% of the vote in European elections. 2009, I've given half the Tories, because the Tories had left the EPP at this point. And it says 52.4, because I hadn't. There were some particularly weird tiny parties in Ulster, anyway, which I've now politically gone through. And so I said 52.9%. that's the rise of far right voting. If you define the far right as white or European mainstream conservatives, you may have a different definition of far right than that. And so we're in a particular position in the UK where we're governed by an alliance of two parties, one of which, the DUP, formally and officially does not believe in evolution. This is true. They don't, you know. If Brexit was to go through, I think it would strengthen the Brexiteers, the European Research Group, Nigel Farage, and so on. If it doesn't go through, there's a delay, it depends on how we deal with it. And how we deal with that. But the far right is not rising in most of Europe. In as many countries as it's risen, it's fallen. The New York Times every year has a graph. And we always talk about how big rises. Not even all of them have a much smaller increase than they were. It's fallen. It's fallen in Vienna. There's one free thing in the MPs, you know, a couple of Swedish nasties, as I've seen. But it's not something that's sweeping the globe. It's the most unequal, dysfunctional countries get far right politicians and votes. And it's very similar. Probably Greer tells this chilling story. And the chilling story is about the local politician who was new, who helped people when they couldn't get a council house and sorted them out and so on. She did it really, she took it for 15 minutes, and you think she's talking about now. And she's actually reading an extract from an account in Germany in 1934 of how the Nazi Party got support by helping people with their problems. But the Nazi Party got support in Germany because things were falling apart. Income inequality in Germany in the 30s was shooting up along with inflation. Income inequality in Japan was shooting up. Populist voting is a symptom of societal breakdown. And if you don't want to have populist politicians, populist voters, you need to make sure your society isn't breaking down so that people don't say, none of them are fixing it, I'm going to try somebody new. What? One over here?
And you haven't said very much about sovereignty. How much of a part do you think that played in the development?
Oh, sovereignty. I just don't think. I don't think the majority of voters would be able to define it. It's not something that matters to most people. Politics doesn't matter to most people. We do this silly thing of asking people, it's just an election tomorrow, how would you vote? Asking people about something they don't think about. You're slightly weird because you've come to a talk like this tonight. And the rest of the people in this island are a bit more normal. Most people care deeply about certain things, but don't see politics as important. But then even smaller is the idea of self-determination and who's actually in control or not. There are times when it rises up, so wartime, of course, it rises up, it really matters to people in control. And you can rise it up in Scotland, which is the Scottish nationalists have done brilliantly and slowly over time. You know, we did English, did things like giving them the poll tax first, and let all the shipyards of the tribe go first and so on, try to encourage the Scots to do this. But most people are not that interested. If they were interested in sovereignty and who's in control, they altered the voting system in England so that at least your vote actually mattered. Yeah. Most people who vote don't get the party they vote for. So it's a very weird kind of democracy in England. Whereas in the rest of the continent, at least you get the party you vote for, and you also get more parties, which means you're more likely to actually get a politician who you might like, because there is, you know, a hard right Tory, a middle Tory, a left-wing Tory, and so on. There's well, there's a lovely party in Greece called the River, which only has about 20 members, but you know, it's a party I really like, and if I was in Greece, I'd vote for the River. And it would have a tiny effect. That's sovereignty for me. The vote actually mattering is as important as what the jurisdiction is. The EU took and spent about 1% of our income. So it's pretty small in terms of losing sovereignty. An interesting question would be, who could complain about the EU? Given I've tried to show you that we benefited massively, there will be parts of Europe where this is a disbenefit too. They're losing their young. So young may send a few pounds back to the farm where their parents are slowly going into adultage. But you know, what kind of a deal is that? I think it'll be interesting to touch on that. We ended the book that this talk is based on, it's called War Britannia. And the end of it looks at the map that Freddie Heineken, the beer magnate, produced, trying to predict the future of Europe. And he hired two historians. And what they did is suggest that the large countries, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, and Britain, would break up. Germany, in a way, only has Rwanda, sort of slightly separate. It wouldn't have been taken very seriously, but they got Yugoslavia spot on in terms of what actually then happened subsequently. And you can kind of guess what happens to the UK. Scotland and Ireland are relatively easy. The fascinating thing is the rest of it. And the genius was Yorkshire, which gets its own country, but they put Newcastle as the capital to keep the Geordies on board. We should stop there and see if I can draw to you one last question.
I should have a question, Mr. Cox.
Should we do you?
Thank you.
Hold on, let's find the balance and we can ask the actors.
You said that Margaret, that Mrs. May had done a very bad job as a Prime Minister. What would you have done differently to deliver a successful Brexit?
Well, Mrs. May was a pupil in my department, not obviously when I taught there, but we actually looked at her textbooks. And one of the geography textbooks in the geography department at Oxford begins on the first page. At the end of the first page begins, and so you are a citizen of the world. So I certainly wouldn't have done any citizens of nowhere, citizens of the world kind of thing. What I would have done if I was Theresa May is exactly almost as she has done, right up until now, like this. The only thing I would do differently is, and it depends on my sense of theatre, whether I would take it through to 29, 10 o'clock away. If I have the guts, I would walk in during the absolute catastrophe as you look like you're going to break out into Parliament at, say, 6 o'clock at night on the 29th of March. And I would do a speech. My speech would begin with, I absolutely love my country. It's above all else to me. I'm a patriot. I've worked all my life for my country. I've only had 2 hours sleep a night for the last 2 years. I have 4 serious illnesses. And yet I've done everything that I can. We have tried to do this, we've tried to do that, we've tried everything, and none of it has worked, and it's not because of me. And because of this, I sent a letter to Brussels yesterday revoking Article 50. Do with me what you will. That's what I would do if I was Mrs. May. I haven't sent the speech. What I have done is this publisher had an article in the Oxford magazine saying that if Mrs. May wants to do that, we should replace a statue of Cecil Rhodes on the High Street with a statue of Mrs. May. Anyway, I don't think it will work, but that would be my main plan. And if my partner works in finance, as Mrs. May's partner does, and was telling me the implications, you know, you never, never know.
But that's not delivering a successful Brexit.
It could be the most successful that we could have had. And I might call it a delay. But of course, a delay requires the EU27 to agree to a delay.
It's not successful.
Whereas a
war. You're criticising her for doing a bad job, and you're saying you couldn't do the job at all. So,
it's successful because it turns out that that was the best option, having tried everything else.
So, people voted to leave, they got to leave.
There's no chance. Well, you could still call it leave. There'd be a way, but I'm not a politician. There will be a way in which I call it a red, white and blue special kind of league. I don't know if you've left in spirit.
That'll be right.
Oh, don't have the MEPs for 5 years, which is one way of clearing them out. But, she, you know, you've got to give her a little bit of sympathy. She's dogged at Oxford as a student. She was always the one who worked the longest and hardest on her essays and did her homework. She could just never come to a decision. So what have all the tutors say? Thank you.
Professor Dorling, on behalf of all the weird people gathered here, thank you. I think you've done exactly what you said you would do. You've entertained us. I suspect you've upset a few people. You may have even depressed a few people, but you've also made us laugh. And you've certainly given us a lot to think about and given us a different perspective on the subject that I'm sure we're all going to be talking about for a long time yet to come, whatever happens in the House of Commons tomorrow. So thank you very much. It's been very entertaining. Thank you, everybody.